Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Rui Teixeira, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and an author or co-author of several books on American politics, including The Emerging Democratic Majority, written with John Judas. His latest book is The Optimistic Leftist, Why the 21st Century Will Be Better Than You Think. And he is the co-author of a new report at the Center for American Progress, Voter Trends in 2016, A Final Examination. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rui Teixeira.
Glad to be here.
And just to touch on your report, of course, last week marked the one-year anniversary of Donald Trump's victory. And ever since then, I think Democrats have been despondent, if not alarmed, at what's happened both in terms of domestic and foreign policy. There was a bit of a change in that tide of depression last Tuesday with the good Democratic results in both Virginia and in New Jersey, as well as the completion of what they call the blue wall here on the West Coast with Democratic victories in the state of Washington. So are you a little more optimistic this week than you were last week?
Well, I would say that my long-range optimism hasn't changed, because that's really what the book that I recently put out is about. That, you know, broadly speaking, if you look over the course of, you know, a number of decades, if you look over the likely course of the 21st century, I do think the values and priorities of the left are likely to triumph, and we're likely to see a more prosperous and more just world. I do think that's sort of the general trend over time, even if bad things happen, you know, two steps forward, one step back. Well, one step back was certainly the election of Donald Trump, from which I think some people took the lesson. And of course, looking at the events in, you know, some events in Europe, some bad outcomes there, people are sort of worried about that as well. It's like this rising tide of reactionary, even quasi-racist populism was going to overwhelm the Western world in general, and the United States in particular, and woe is us. Well, I didn't think that the election of Donald Trump was anything but bad, but I always thought that the reaction to it was a little bit overstated. I did think that populism was likely to have a relatively short shelf life, that voters would get tired of it, that the rising constituencies that these movements ignore were just going to get bigger. And since they were unlikely to be able to deliver for the very voters who put them in office, there would likely be a backlash there as well. And it just didn't add up to a winning formula over time. So I'm more optimistic, I guess, in the sense that of the timing. I mean, I wasn't sure how long this sort of backlash might take to develop, and how long it might take for voters to lose interest in what Trump had to offer, and or for his unpopularity to really start hurting the Republican Party. But I think that's already happened. You know, and it's too early to say, oh, well, you know, the Democrats will certainly do great in 2018, 2020, and beyond. But there's no gainsaying the fact that this was a very bad result for the Republicans. And it does not appear like Donald Trump has repealed the laws of politics and or can defy political gravity.
Well, but let's go back to the 1970s. I want to get a sense from you what happened to the liberal majority in this country, because back then, and for some decades prior to that, the Democrats had a massive majority in the Senate and the House, and they also had a real liberal majority on the Supreme Court, with real liberals like Thurgood Marshall and William O. Douglas, as opposed to the idea that, you know, we have arch conservatives now and sort of moderate Democrats or centrist Democrats. So the country has moved so rapidly and radically to the right, particularly in the judiciary. Did the liberals in this country what happened to them? Did they lose heart? They had it made, and they had so much political power, and it's just been dissipating over the decades. And I wonder whether there's a psychological component as well as a political one.
I guess I wouldn't say it's you know, terribly psychological. I think the underlying reason why the left in the U.S. has done relatively poorly in the last number of decades, and I think the same thing is true of Europe, is that fundamentally the left, and this is a point I try to make in my book, it actually tends to be better off when capitalism is performing well and people's living standards are rising with some of some degree of certainty, where people see their lives getting better and they have hope for the future. In a situation in which growth slows down and inequality rises, reaction inevitably sets in. And I think that's what we've seen across the Western world, including in the United States. So the Republicans, for example, looking specifically at the United States, were able to take advantage of this shift in the political economy to make their case to what formerly was a Democratic-leaning constituency, white working class or non-college-educated voters. And if you look at the data, it's very clear that that is a constituency upon which they built their improved fortunes over time. Now, that is a rapidly diminishing constituency, but it's still quite large in the United States, and certainly large enough to help the Republicans do well politically, particularly when you take into account other factors, gerrymandering, the geographic concentration of Democratic voters in more urbanized areas, the small state bias in the Senate. And there's a number of things that actually, particular to the U.S. political system, that help the Republicans sort of overperform their actual support among the public as a whole. So I think, you know, that happened in terms of, you know, the change in political economy and how the Republicans reacted to it. And I think if you want to fault the Democrats, and I think there's certainly fault to go around, I think they failed to understand or to take seriously enough that these changes were taking place, that capitalism, in fact, was evolving in a way that was against the interests of most people and certainly against the interests of the left, and that they had to have a sort of more robust approach to improving it. The old Keynesian welfare state, as productive as it was in many ways, clearly needed an update, and they had to kind of get on the case. Instead, I think they tended to tack a bit to the right and accept the prevailing economic arrangements. There was a famous third way in the 90s, which, you know, I think it's fair to say was characterized by sort of an acceptance of how capitalism and globalization were evolving and sort of, well, let's just accept that's going on and let's try to redistribute the benefits from that a little bit better than they've been taking. But we don't want to interfere with the market. We don't want to interfere with how capitalism has been evolving. So I think, you know, in very broad brush, I think that's what's happened to the left, is they've sort of lost the plot and now they're sort of regaining it. I think it's important to point out that despite this period of relatively good fortunes for the right and relatively poor fortunes for the left, it's not as if nothing good has happened in this time period. It's not as if the right has succeeded in blowing up the welfare state, either here or in Europe. I mean, by and large, the state is about as big as it's ever been. They prevented it from going farther. They prevented improvements from being made in the way government functions and the services it delivers for people, but by no means have they been able to eliminate them. And look what happened under Obama. Despite the poor economic circumstances, they actually made quite a lot of advances in terms of improving the American government and improving the kind of services it could provide to constituents. And of course, now that they've been made, they're extremely hard to get rid of. I mean, this is really the root of the Republican crash and burn on the Obamacare repeal and replace. People don't like it once they have benefits, right. Once they get something that they feel improves their lives. They don't want it taken away.
Surprise.
Thing has been true in Europe as well.
Right. Well, that is, of course, the argument for social democracy. And frankly, I'm always amazed that we don't make a better argument on the left for social democracy as they have in Europe. And it's also puzzling, of course, that after the Marshall Plan gave Western Europe social democracy, but not necessarily here at home. And the argument shouldn't be about big government versus smaller government. It should be about better government. And the idea that you pay your taxes and get your government services has somehow been lost or been beaten down and extinguished by this kind of Republican canard that started under Reagan.
I certainly agree with that. And I think that one thing that's happening now at the left, again, both here and in other places, is that I think they're realizing that giving in to that kind of, you know, view of government is not a good idea. That you may think you need to tack a bit to the right in that stuff to reach so-called swing voters, but in reality, it's not really a program that benefits the left over the long haul, and certainly doesn't benefit the countries in which the left tries to improve things. By and large, if you want people to support government, get government to function better, and try to have a more healthy economic growth model than the ones we've had. And that's really the key. But simply giving in to the rhetoric about how government, you know, is intrinsically wasteful, intrinsically bad for people, it's just too big, we need to cut it down. I mean, this was kind of a bad bet on the part of certain parts of the left, that sort of by trying to mollify those sentiments, they could sneak in the back door, and I don't think it worked.
And again, I'm speaking with Rui Teixeira, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the author or co-author of several books on American politics, including The Emerging Democratic Majority, written with John Judas. His latest book is The Optimistic Leftist, Why the 21st Century Will Be Better Than You Think. And he is the co-author of a new report at the Center for American Progress, Voter Trends in 2016, A Final Examination. Now, earlier when you were talking about the challenges the reasons why the right has been more successful, clearly there are more, the Democrats have a natural majority, it would seem. There are more average folks than there are rich folks, but they do not seem to be able to inspire all of their people to come out to vote, whereas the right seem to be able to get every last Republican out to vote. But they do have some structural changes that seems to be a way to maintain a Republican majority, even though they are in effect a minority, and that is gerrymandering, as you mentioned, and the concentration of blue voters in urban areas. And over time, I understand that there's some serious challenges here. We could end up in a couple of decades with 60% of the U.S. Senate elected by 40% of the country in terms of red states, and we could end up with the last election where the Democrat got 3 million more votes than the Republican, yet he became president, that could become the new normal with the way the Electoral College is structured, even though it's at times favored Democrats, but lately favored Republicans. So let's talk about those structural problems. And of course, adding to that, you have the fact that Citizens United has given unlimited plutocratic money to the Republican Party that's both unlimited and invisible. So let's start with those structural problems. How do you undo gerrymandering, and can you undo the Electoral College?
Right. Well, I think there are several things that mitigate this problem, even though there's no question it's a problem and no question that it's been leveraged extremely effectively by the Republicans. To begin with, gerrymandering can be un-gerrymandered, so, you know, to some extent. So obviously, it becomes important that Democrats have more of a voice and role in the redistricting process, and or you change the redistricting process so it's essentially more neutral. I think these things are doable, and I think the Democrats are taking them much more seriously than they have. And if you look at the sort of the election cycles that are coming up, the Democrats might actually have a good chance to do well in the elections that will determine who controls redistricting. So that's one thing. Another thing is these districts are not stable. In other words, demographically, even when you gerrymander districts and you sort of try to, you know, create more 55-45 districts for your party and a bunch of 80-20 districts for the other guys, so they waste their votes, those 55-45 districts, just to pick a number, are not stable. The constituencies in those, the demographic constituencies, the mix of them change over time, and even their preferences and inclinations may change over time. So it's not a guarantee that you're going to be able to continue to control those districts simply by virtue of having drawn the lines 10 years ago. But a good example is what happened in the Virginia legislative elections on Tuesday, which is that, I mean, that's a heavily gerrymandered state, especially in terms of the state legislature, and the Democrats, I mean, it looked like people thought the Democrats could never, you know, take back the assembly, House of Delegates, you know, for decades. And yet they've either done it or come very close. I mean, they picked up somewhere between 14 and 16 seats, making it about an even split from a 66-34 Republican majority. So these things can be overcome. And this actually relates to a third point about, you know, how you deal with these structural obstacles. The way you deal with structural obstacles is, you know, in broad brush, you try to A, change them, and B, you try to work as hard as you can within those constraints to maximize your political impact. So I think it's fair to say the Democrats have kind of fallen down on the job in terms of competing in a lot of rural and small town America and some parts of ex-urban metro America as well. So the idea that you can compete without actually putting, sort of shoes on the ground there, and without working hard in these areas, without trying to take advantage of whatever leverage you have, is probably incorrect. I think Democrats are now realizing that they really have to compete as close as possible to everywhere. They need a 50-state strategy. They need a 3,143-county strategy. Howard Dean had this right, those many years ago, when he was trying to push that idea within the Democratic Party. I think that idea has reawakened, and I think is being taken quite seriously. Now, none of this to say that, we're not still going to see structural advantages for the Republicans going forward. There's a certain amount of this that can't be gotten rid of, or at least gotten rid of anytime soon. But I think the Democrats are realizing that they have to work it a bit harder and both try to change the playing field and play better on the playing field itself. So, yeah, I don't see where the Republicans have any kind of an electoral lock at this point. It strikes me as being very, very fragile, that Electoral College victory in 2016, unless you believe that suddenly these are all red states. I mean, all the states that the Republicans flipped in 2016, they're all lost, Iowa, Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. I don't believe that. I think they're still quite competitive.
Well, but in terms of the Electoral College, of course, there is this movement, the National Popular Vote, which is a simple mechanism to do an end run around a constitutional amendment, which is a heavy lift. But it's mostly gotten Democratic votes to sign on. Well, Rui Teixeira, let's take a brief station break and we'll be back and continue the conversation. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And we're continuing the conversation with Rui Teixeira, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the author and co-author of several books on American politics, including Emerging Democratic Majority, written with John Judas. His latest book is The Optimistic Leftist, Why the 21st Century Would Be Better Than You Think. And he is the co-author of a new report at the Center for American Progress, Voter Trends in 2016, A Final Examination. So a year on from Donald Trump's election, my sense, Rui, is that even though Trump himself may not last very long, and if the Democrats take back the House in 2018, which more and more likely that they certainly have an improving chance of doing that, there may be an impeachment. But on the other hand, my sense is that that's not a particularly healthy thing to rely on, the idea that it's, we're better than the other guy, which unfortunately has been too often the mantra. It might be better to work on a new, narrative and platform and policies as opposed to hoping that this disastrous aberration will somehow self-destruct. What's your take on that?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think that there's only so much leverage you can gain from simply opposing the other side. It's very useful to help you get into office, or certainly part of what you need to use to get into office. But in the end, it comes down to what do you really stand for, and what are you going to do once you're actually in office? How are you really going to change people's lives? How are you going to make the economy function better, and so on? That's really the only way to stop populism in the medium to long run, is you make the country function better and deliver benefits for more people, and help communities that are being left behind be not so left behind. People need hope for the future, and it's not enough just to oppose the other side. You have to actually have something going on your side, and you have to try to implement that as effectively as you can once you do gain office, for however long you are in office. So I think I've written many, many things over the years, and going back to that book, The Emerging Democratic Majority, that you mentioned, that discussed, among other things, that the Democrats were benefited to some extent by the way the country was evolving demographically. But I always tried to emphasize that you ultimately you have to deliver for people. You have to govern better. You have to do a better job of sort of cutting into the Republican margins among groups like white non-college voters who do clearly feel left behind, and there are some reasons why they feel that. So, I think that the road ahead is actually fairly clear in terms of what the Democrats need to do, and they should not let themselves be diverted by sort of picking up on the latest outrage that Donald Trump puts into play. I think it's sort of fool's gold. I mean, you benefit from it in the short run, and certainly it'd be crazy not to try to take advantage of, but it's not the real thing. It's not the prize. It's not what you should be aiming for.
But I think one of the things that Donald Trump did successfully, and I think it was largely by default, because it's kind of the opposite of Hillary Clinton's remarks about the basket full of deplorables. What I hear from conservatives and Trump voters, and particularly some who voted for Obama but then voted for Trump, is that somehow, and we know that the idea of the elites is a complete canard, because the people who fund the Republican Party, like the Koch brothers and the Mercers, are truly the elites. We've just learned from the Paradise Papers how much money they've salted away overseas, and which means that we have to pay more taxes because they don't pay taxes. So they are the real elites, and clearly the Koch brothers are the only beneficiary so far of the Republican successes, if that's the right word, in the Congress. Almost everything that's been passed, not that anything much has been passed, but a lot of changes at the regulatory level have all benefited the Koch brothers. So it's a pay-for-play system for sure, and that the working-class people who voted for Trump are going to get hosed. But you can't tell them that you bought a lemon. People don't like to be told that they made a bad investment. But it would seem to me it wouldn't be very difficult to start being sort of more generous and kinder towards people that voted for Trump. And I don't know how you make that argument across this barrier or this divide, this silo of information where you've got the Fox bubble that's telling everybody that Trump is great and that the mainstream media is all about fake news. And then everything in the real media is not believed. It doesn't seem to have the impact it should have. So we do have, alternative universes there. But just at a purely sort of, I don't know whether psychological, but certainly on a personal level, it would seem to me that a little humility might be helpful.
Yeah, I certainly couldn't agree with that more. It's not just that you don't want to just hammer people for making a dumb investment, which is sort of how it comes across at times when people talk about folks who voted for Trump. But what's worse, I think, is that it's very comforting, it seems to me, for people on the left and liberals, or they find it comforting to basically describe these people as all racists and beyond the pale, and they're just reactionaries, troglodytes, the polite people shouldn't have anything to do with them. That is really toxic. I mean, when people feel that kind of attitude emanating from Democrats, the left, from liberals, it turns them off completely, and you can't possibly reach them, even if they have things they're dissatisfied about with Trump or with the Republican Party, and you can't get them to listen to maybe your ideas about how you can make their communities better. So, yeah, I think it starts with that. You have the respect that people have complicated motives for what they do. There are indeed some hardcore racists, but that's just not the whole story, and it's certainly not all the people who voted for Trump. So, yeah, I think the left needs to take a good hard look at its attitude about some of these things and try to, as you say, being more, sort of open-armed and open-hearted about people who disagree with them.
And in terms of Trump's lasting legacy, which I think will be pretty thin, and mostly it'll be a trail of wreckage, both domestically and in terms of foreign policy. But the one thing I think that he has achieved is he's changed the political dialogue, in as much as if you watch him at his rallies, he does engage the audience. Now, it's true he's a huckster and it's all a con, but he does engage them, even if he's talking incredibly in very simplistic terms. you can see the people like being talked to in that way because he's not a politician. And I don't know too many politicians who aren't politicians. Maybe Al Franken from Minnesota, he talks like a real person. But, you know, I was watching Chuck Schumer just after the terrorist incident in New York, where he was attacked savagely by Trump, completely erroneously. But rather than, you know, nail Trump for his lies, he sort of said in this cute way, "It's time, Mr. President, to stop tweeting and start governing," and in that rhythm of politicians. And I guarantee you, that is not working anymore. I think that's the main change that Trump has made. What's your sense of that? Do you think that can you name too many politicians who don't sound like politicians?
Well, that is tough. I mean, I guess it's more politicians who do a little bit better job sounding not like politicians rather than completely don't sound like politicians. I mean, I suppose people like Elizabeth Warren or Sherrod Brown are a little bit better, but I think it's a matter of degree, not of kind. I do think that, though I agree with you, I think that Trump has put into play the idea that you really need to talk American in a sense. You need to talk in a way that people can relate to and find at least somewhat authentic, and that if you come off as just a pal, just an elite, that's kind of a bad look these days. All across the Western world, people are rejecting elites and think that, you know, they're just caught in their own elite bubble and they're really lost touch with most people in most communities, and it's just all bull. So I think there's a real premium at this point for politicians who can figure out how to connect directly to people and take out that politician speak filter that you're alluding to. Easier said than done, I might add, but I do think there's a premium there.
Well, given that our audience are mostly leftists, give us your final invocation for why you're an optimist and why you believe in the optimistic leftists being that the 21st century will be better than you think.
Well, I'll just give you two simple reasons. The first is, I think that if you look over the history of the 20th century and even the early 21st century, what's striking about the world is that it's gotten to be a much better place. I mean, if you look at all the indicators of health, life expectancy, food, nutrition, you know, the amount of services are available to people, education levels, how well people live, living standards. I mean, if you look in over fairly long periods of time, it's clear we live in a richer, more prosperous, a more just, more democratic, more tolerant world than we ever have before. So I think that's cause for optimism. Now, that doesn't mean everything that's happened is great. It just means that on net, over time, we're actually making significant progress. And the second thing I'd say, which I think is very important, is I think people are coming around to the idea when they look at the economy that the animal, so-called animal spirits of capitalists and investors are very important. They're really affected by how they feel what they feel their economic opportunities are, and they don't feel like investing if they're not feeling it. They don't have those spirits. They're not going to do it, and that contributes to economic stagnation and sometimes outright recession and depression. So if we believe that capitalists are affected by these animal spirits, well, why not the left as well? You know, if the animal spirits of the left are essentially lacking, people are just pessimistic. They think no matter how hard we try, we can't stop global warming. Everything's been a crock of shit since 1970. You know, I think that's really has a material effect on the ability of the left to unleash its energies. Conversely, if people have a optimistic, forward-looking, hey, we're actually making progress, we can actually get things done, these are solvable problems, let's go out and do it, I think those animal spirits can be leveraged, you know, for a much more successful left that makes progress a lot faster than perhaps we have in the past. So that's what I'd say. Get those animal spirits going.
Well, Rui Teixeira, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Sure, my pleasure.
And again, I mean, speak with Rui Teixeira, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the author or co-author of several books on American politics, including The Emerging Democratic Majority, written with John Judas. His latest book is The Optimistic Leftist, Why the 21st Century Will Be Better Than You Think. And he is the co-author of a new report at the Center for American Progress, Voter Trends in 2016, A Final Examination. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcast at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
see you.